supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
On November 12th, a black woman walking on the campus of Villanova University was attacked by a group of men shouting, "Trump." I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Some students think that Villanova's school culture, in and out of the classroom, is at least partially to blame for the incident's racial overtones. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that ongoing efforts to change the curriculum at the majority white Catholic university have gotten a mixed reception.
Villanova freshman Victoria Nelson has light brown hair and a spray of freckles on her cheeks. She says because of the way she looks, she thinks one of her professors this year felt comfortable airing certain opinions in class.
Referring to black people as those people, and then when I asked why that was offensive, he said, "Well, they're not like you and me." And that's very offensive to me because I'm biracial, my dad's black, and another comment included, he said that slavery was necessary in America because someone needed to do the work.
There are now around 600, or about 10% more undergraduate students of color at Villanova than there were 10 years ago. The campus, located in wealthy Radnor Township, is still three-quarters white. Following this year's presidential election, students of color from the University of Pennsylvania to Villanova to area high schools bore the brunt of racial slurs and violence. At Villanova, Nelson belongs to a small group of students lobbying for changes to the core curriculum, which includes a hefty dose of Catholic education. At a recent group meeting, sophomore Gabriella Pucce and senior Brendan Carcitti say the point of changing the conversation around, say, St. Augustine, is to influence school culture outside the classroom.
Because if you're teaching that Augustine is a black man from northern, or a man of color from northern Africa, which is something that is glossed over, maybe something like the words white power would not be written in the tunnel, right?
That's the same SEPTA tunnel where the student was attacked. At Villanova, recruiting students, faculty, and staff from a variety of backgrounds has been on the administration's agenda since at least 2004. But getting course offerings to reflect a more diverse student body has been a process. The very first academic program with a big focus on race, called intergroup relations, came with a bribe.
The way that we started it was the students got no credit and came primarily because I cooked them dinner. And to goodness, I cooked them dinner.
Terry Nance is a professor of communications and newly named associate vice provost of diversity and inclusion. Now, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, which enrolls about half of Villanova undergrads, requires students to take two electives with a diversity component. Adele Lindenmeyer is dean of the college.
They're not just courses that are like just add women and STIR, or just add African Americans and check its diversity. So we make sure the courses talk about power and influence and context.
But mandating classes on religious, ethnic, or racial differences has gotten pushback from some students and faculty. Derek Fake is vice president of the Villanova College Republicans.
That's incredibly dangerous, is if you start forcing more requirements on people who wouldn't voluntarily be taking the courses.
By dangerous, he says he means alienating to students who are more politically conservative. Fake also says he likes the focus on European philosophers and Christian values covered in the four required liberal arts and science classes.
Because I think what's really lacking in our society isn't so much diverse opinion, because that can be something that's easily sought out after if you want to. But we don't understand where we come from as a culture.
Moving forward, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences is staying away from more mandates, says Dean Lindenmeyer. Instead, each department has a diversity committee of its own. Sophomore Gabriella Pucce says concerned students are now looking for more representative course offerings outside the humanities. Even as many on campus, faculty and students shy away from hard conversations.
Because Villanova is kind of an, I don't want to say apolitical, but apathetic. It's apolitical, and people are apathetic. And we're all really nice, and we all just want to get along, and we don't want to touch on any, like, step on anyone's toes.
I've heard about this concept of
Villanova nice, right?
Stepping on toes gets attention. Puche and her cohort say even before the election, the administration seemed more receptive to student protests and demands than in years past. Now they've got a big target in their sights, getting Villanova's business school to make a point of including more diversity in its teachings. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Patients in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease can lose their sense of smell. Scientists at the University of Pennsylvania have found that a smell test can help detect a condition called mild cognitive impairment earlier than a memory assessment alone can. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman reports.
Dr. David Rolfe, an assistant professor in psychiatry, studies the relationship between smell and neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's.
The sense of smell gives us kind of a window into the brain. We can use the nose as a window into the brain.
In particular, his research has opened a window on identifying mild cognitive impairment, which the Mayo Clinic calls an intermediate stage between expected cognitive decline of normal aging and the more serious decline of dementia.
The most traditional way of screening for mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease is to give a memory test. And that works pretty well when somebody has full-blown Alzheimer's disease. But in the preclinical stage, those cognitive or memory screens aren't as sensitive or as specific as we would like them to be.
But by asking patients to identify different scents infused in magic markers, researchers were able to diagnose them more accurately than by testing memory alone. Rolfe says catching someone's illness earlier helps families create a safer environment for the patient and a better care plan. His next goal is to shorten the smell assessment so that primary care doctors will be able to administer it during a normal 15-minute checkup. Anne Hoffman, WHYY News.
Following the tragedy in Oakland, California 3 weeks ago, when a fire at a dance party in a converted warehouse space killed 36 people, artists living and working in similar conditions in Philadelphia got spooked. One, because no one wants another tragedy, and two, because they don't want the city to evict them from their spaces. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on talks between City Hall and Philadelphia's Creative Underground.
Philadelphia is full of old and abandoned manufacturing warehouses, and local curator Eric Prizendance says it's just a fact of life that they will be used, legally or not, in ways they were never intended.
If you go into a location that hosts midnight dance raves or something and you shut it down, the speakers and the DJ and the audience just move. They're not going to take a long, hard think about it and decide not to do it anymore. They're just going to move and continue to exercise their artistic goals.
Prizendance is a member of the Little Berlin Artist Collective in Philly's Kensington neighborhood. This week, he and other collectives across the city are meeting to share best practices to make their buildings safer and to discuss how to approach the city for help without triggering evictions. The city is maintaining a safety-first stance, advising artists to seek out spaces that are up to code and above board. And the mayor's Cultural Advisory Council has formed a working group to ponder how to help emerging artists as a means to grow Philadelphia's creative economy. The problem is a city bureaucracy and the cultural underground do not always see eye to eye. Kelsey Halliday Johnson, a member of the Vox Artist Collective, is coordinating this meeting of collectives, and she says a lot of these artists are trying to reject and reinvent the creative economy.
I hope that inherently there will always be that difference, because artists are trying to create a system and economy that is inherently different than the norm we see around us.
City Hall has stepped into the fringes of Philadelphia culture before, when the Fringe Festival began 20 years ago. Empty buildings in Old City were cheap venues for experimental theater. Fringe founder Nick Stuccio discovered that both artists and their audiences craved the adventure and risk of discovering abandoned places.
They were big, beautiful timbers, old wooden floors, beautiful brick walls. These are nice spaces to be in. Yeah, some of them were rickety and they weren't necessarily code compliant. We learned very early, like end of year one, that we had to play right with the city. We wanted the city as our partner. The city, from the very beginning, never said no to us, but they did want us to fess up and work with them.
So the Fringe Festival and the City of Philadelphia came to a mutual understanding. The festival now mandates that all artists have insurance for their performance spaces, and the city, for its part, rewrote its licensing code to allow for a more lenient temporary occupancy permit. It paid off for both parties. The Fringe Festival is now a mainstay of the city's cultural life, with a permanent home on the waterfront, and it helps make Center City economically vibrant.
In these 20 years, every cool industrial space is now a condo.
Stuccio is talking about gentrification, which lurks in the background of any discussion about urban artist spaces. As formerly abandoned buildings become enlivened with artists, they become more valuable, eventually pricing out the artists who started the rejuvenation. Some don't want to be part of that economic cycle. Gwen Rooker is a multidisciplinary theater artist who adamantly steers clear of a profit motive.
I just have this desire to make stuff and to share it with other people and to not have it have everything go in a little counter and a little piggy bank and then, you know, write down what it's all for.
Rooker is part of an artist collective that uses a former factory building in West Philadelphia. The building has its problems. When I visited in mid-December, the building had not had heat for 2 weeks due to a gas problem, so inside it was sub-freezing 25 degrees. Rooker does not want to disclose the name of the collective nor its location to avoid tipping off the city to its code violations. Another member of the collective, Morgan Fitzpatrick Andrews, has other concerns. He's been watching incidents of hate speech and violent harassment increase since Donald Trump won the presidential election.
This is a witch hunt. You know, when people see art and culture that they don't understand, they're going to persecute that.
Defenders of the underground argue that these spaces, existing on the down low, might be physically risky, but creatively they are safe. This is where experiments in art and identity can happen without judgment. Rooker says if the collective was concerned about being socially acceptable and economically solvent, it just wouldn't work.
We don't know how to do a lot of the things that the mainstream people know how to do to hermetically seal themselves off from everything. I mean, I think part of my generosity is like a little bit in balance with my own, my lack of finesse at keeping everything buttoned down.
For artists like Rooker, the ability to build community with other artists outside of social and financial pressures is possible only because of the affordability of former industrial buildings with maybe some inspection issues. The city has not indicated how strict or lenient its inspections will be in artist spaces. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Many communities in North and Central New Jersey have been experiencing a drought since October. Over the past 20 years, overdevelopment and population shifts have been putting pressure on the state's water supply. But a plan to manage New Jersey's water resources is decades overdue, and critics say it's been languishing on Governor Chris Christie's desk for 5 years. From our fellow public radio station WNYC, Karen Rouse offers this report.
Legislators in Trenton are looking for it.
I want to mention the New Jersey statewide water supply plan, last adopted 2 decades ago, is long overdue for a revision.
Former Governor James Florio hasn't seen it either.
The water supply plan should be updated. I mean, it's clearly out of sorts in terms of timing. It's been a while.
And Rutgers professor Daniel Van Abs says the 15-year delay is causing a lot of suspicion.
Because there are an awful lot of people who are out there saying, why isn't this water supply plan out? And immediately we get the theories about, well, there must be something in the plan that the state government as it is now, this administration, doesn't want to see out there.
Environmentalist David Pringle goes even further.
It's a cover-up, short and simple.
Pringle is the lobbyist for Clean Water Action. He says Governors James McGreevy and John Corzine, both Democrats, failed to advance the plan for providing enough safe drinking water for all of New Jersey. And it continues to stall under Chris Christie.
Either the governor is so pro-development at any cost, he doesn't care about any of the other impacts, or his position is we can't handle the truth. Because the truth is, and it varies from place to place, is we have water problems.
Like water shortages that call for building dams or forcing residents to conserve. Whether the missing plan paints such a disastrous picture is hard to say. It hasn't been seen since consultants turned it over to the Christie administration in 2011. And even that draft was already 10 years overdue. Jennifer Coffey is with the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. She says it's a blueprint for ensuring the state has a clean and ample supply of water for the future. Without it, the state is operating from its last plan, from 1996.
It's a recipe for disaster, and we end up in situations like we are this year and the previous year where we're facing a drought. And it came upon us because we weren't paying enough attention.
The New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection says it's still working on the draft water plan that was submitted in 2011. Rutgers professor Daniel Van Abs was a contributor to that plan. He says each successive plan has expanded the water supply to fit growing needs or change how communities use water, like the plan adopted in 1981.
It resulted in a combination of things. One is a couple of new reservoirs, the Manasquan and the Monksville Reservoir up in North Jersey, the designation of two areas in the state, one in Monmouth County, one down near Camden, where we were vastly overpumping groundwater. And so we cut back.
At a recent legislative hearing in Trenton, Daniel Kennedy, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Environmental Protection, was grilled about the 15-year delay to the water supply plan.
It's still in development, and I could commit to you that from a professional and technical perspective, my staff is still working on the data around that. And between Commissioner Martin and the governor's office, we're still working on it.
It would seem to be something that's not...
Assemblyman John McKeon pressed further.
This is a very complex Water One approach, but what's the... Hold up. Is it not a priority? Is it that it's going to be such a bombshell that we're really putting a fine point on it? What's the deal?
Kennedy then told the legislature's task force on drinking water that the agency's data is available to the public online, but he couldn't address why the plan had not yet been completed.
It's above my pay grade to tell you what the policy concerns are.
The plan now sits on the desk of the person with a high enough pay grade. But so far, Governor Christie hasn't signed off on making it public. And until he does, it won't be clear whether the state's future water supply is safe or plentiful. I'm Karen Rouse.
For many, the holidays just wouldn't be the same without a heaping helping of green bean casserole. Rob Zavotsky reports on the local roots of this holiday comfort food.
Back in 1955, when Dorcas Riley of Haddonfield, New Jersey, set out to develop an easy and creative way to encourage people to eat more vegetables, she never imagined her recipe would become a household name.
I was so delighted that people were enjoying it. And I just thought, well, okay, fine. Eat it. Have fun.
Riley graduated from Drexel University with a degree in home economics. While working for Campbell's Soup, she was trying to develop a recipe that could be made from ingredients that most people would be able to find in their kitchens. Fashion and trends may have changed a lot since the 50s. But people across the country are still serving Riley's classic six-ingredient recipe.
You can make it in about 35 minutes, and it is all family-pleasing. And to this day, those ingredients are common ingredients that are in people's homes.
Jane Fryman is the director of Campbell's Consumer Test Kitchen. She oversees developing new recipes for the company. She says the process hasn't changed all that much since Riley's days in the test kitchen. They go through several rounds of tasting before they're released to the public. Peas, lima beans, and corn were all nixed before Riley decided on the final recipe for green bean casserole. Fryman says she's not surprised the concoction including condensed cream of mushroom soup, milk, soy sauce, French fried onions, and a dash of pepper is still on holiday tables today. Campbell's archivist Sarah Rice says green bean casserole was first introduced to the public through print ads in the early 1960s.
There's nothing fancy or snooty about it, but at the same time, it's distinctly American. Anyone and everyone can make it, can afford it, and can cook it. And it doesn't matter who you are or your station, you really are going to enjoy it. It's a classic taste for sure.
Riley's husband Tom says he never gets sick of the dish. He keeps a brag book of his wife's accomplishments and press clippings.
The beauty of the green bean casserole is two or three things. Number one, very few ingredients in it. It's very simple. Anybody can prepare it. Even I can do it. Number two, it tastes very good. And number three, it's easy and inexpensive.
Despite the wild popularity her green bean casserole has maintained over the years, Riley remains incredibly modest about it.
I'm thrilled that people are still enjoying it and passing it on to others.
For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavotsky.
With Christmas fast approaching, many homes feel incomplete right now because they cannot afford a Christmas tree. The old First Reformed United Church of Christ in Philadelphia has a solution to those in need. It's offering free Christmas trees on a first-come, first-served basis. The trees were donated by a farm in Mount Bethel, Pennsylvania. Now, whether your tree was free or not, Philadelphia's Streets Department offers this reminder. They and several civic organizations will be recycling Christmas trees throughout the city on the first two Saturdays of January. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Many a poor urban school might wish for a fairy godmother, and tomorrow evening we'll meet a group of suburban parents who've adopted a pair of North Philadelphia schools through fundraisers and other programs. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.